My name is Clint, and I'm an alcoholic. And I think you've just heard one of the most heartwarming introductions you're ever... touching. This has been a remarkable weekend. I have enjoyed it very, very much, and I appreciate being here. I appreciate your hospitality and your generosity, and I appreciate the time that everybody has taken to make this such a rewarding experience for me and for the people here. I have enjoyed every speaker that has been out here. I think there doesn't really need to be anything added to this get-together. I feel like the essence of this program has been articulated. And I want to thank those that are responsible for putting on. I want to thank Victor and Carol for picking me up at the airport and for taking care of me. I want to, we always hook up somehow. It's never any mystery. You get off that plane and there somebody is and you know, you just know. A couple of years ago I was heading to Indianapolis. I called my secretary the receptionist for messages a couple of days before I left. And she said, well, you certainly live an interesting life. I said, what does that mean? She said, well, you're going to get to spend the weekend in Indianapolis. I said, how do you know that? She said, well, there's a message here from a guy that's going to pick you up at the airport. And I said, what does that say? She said, it says here that you'll know who he is because he has a wooden leg and he'll be carrying a big book. And and sure enough, he had a wooden leg and a big book under his arm, and he'd lost that leg in a motorcycle accident. He was had been a Hell's Angel. He and I got to be, you know, with people that ordinarily wouldn't mix. I mean, we had a lot of fun that weekend together. He had an earring. I gave him a little heat about his earring. And then I shared with others that it wasn't really an earring. What had happened is the Ohio State Wildlife Commission caught him sleeping in the park and tagged his earring. He had a gift for me. He took me to the airport Sunday morning. He asked me if he could. I said, sure. And he had a brown sack. In that brown sack, when I looked into it, was his first wooden foot. And he... A lot of stuff goes through your mind when you... my experience with Victor and Carol has been a little more straight ahead than that. A guy asked me when I was sober a few years what turned out to be an interesting question. He said, give me a list of the 20 craziest things you ever did. And I... didn't know why he asked me to do that. But I made some kind of a list. I don't know how many items were on it when I took it back to him, but I had, I wrote down on there the night I got arrested off of a fire escape at the sorority house of the University of Oregon. I had seen this gal in the tavern earlier, and she almost looked at me, and so I knew she wanted to chat, and I was heading up there to talk to her. And they locked my butt up that night. I went to, I got thrown out of dental school at Oregon a few years later. There's no place for a guy like me to be. It went all right until we started having it didn't go all right, but it started to go bad when they... ask us when the assignment was on Saturday morning to get into the clinic, and we had a patient sitting in the chair. I get drunk on Friday night, and Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, I'm not really... Well, I tremor. I have a... I'll drop some Dexamil, about 30 milligrams of Dexamil in a cup of coffee, and by the time I get into the clinic, I am pretty jumpy, and I got a bad hangover, and I don't smell real good, and they just come out with that new high-speed air-driven handpiece, and yeah, you could take a quadrant of teeth out just twitching, and it was crazy. It was all crazy. I shouldn't have been there. I told my dad. My dad one day turned his attention to me and said, "What are you going to do with your life?" And we rarely spoke. "What are you going to do with your life?" And I said, "I'm going to be a dentist." I don't know why I said that. But he didn't hit me, and so I made a career choice that day. And I got thrown out of dental school. I made a set of dentures for a guy that first... and he'd see me in the clinic the next year because he was bringing his wife up for treatment, and he'd go, "Say." "Something's wrong with my teeth," he said. And they threw me out of there, and I'd been getting deferments from the military, and so I had to go to into the service. But it was to be 6 months before I was going to start a OCS program with the Marine Corps. During that 6 months, I lived in a rooming house in Portland. And all my dreams of having some kind of life seemed to be gone. I drank on Skid Row. I like Skid Row drinking. It's easy drinking. In a sense that all the pretense is gone. It's not, they don't ask questions on Skid Row like, "How are you?" and things like that. It doesn't come up. They just, and I came out of a blackout one day in one of those bars, brightly lit. Cafes, they called them, but they were, I guess because of the pickled pig's feet on the bar, but they were just bars. And we drank there. The Indians drank there. I drank there. And sometimes a cop would stroll through, but they wouldn't bother you unless there was a fight. And I came out of a blackout, and I'm sitting at a table, a wooden table, and across from me is a gal, a woman that I had no idea who she was. But I got, I was curious because it felt like we were together. You know what I mean? She seemed to have her things with her in paper bags. And I didn't know where we'd met or what the nature of our relationship was or how long we'd been together or her name. I would have asked her, but she was sleeping. She had a little chili on her cheek, so I knew we'd had dinner. Some delicate flower that I had invited to dine that night. There's a line in one of the stories in the back of the book that kind of capsulizes my life. He says, "Somehow I got out of there. Somehow I got out of there." And whether it was a marriage or a bar or a jail cell or school, somehow I got out of there. I don't know how I got there, and I can't tell you how I got out of there, but somehow I got out of there. That line resonates for me, and I got out of there. And it was on my list of the crazy stuff. I went in the Marine Corps, and it wasn't long before I got transferred out to the West Coast from Quantico. And I had a little brown bar on my collar, a commission, and I liked it. I liked the Marine Corps. There never came the day that I didn't want to do a good job. And I stood in front of the commander one morning while he read me a letter of reprimand. While he told me there isn't any room in the Marine Corps for an alcoholic, Lieutenant. And I knew he was wrong. My brass is polished, my shoes are shined, I've got my uniform on right, and he thinks I'm an alcoholic. And when I left there, I knew I was not. I knew his judgment was bad if he thought I was. And I knew I needed a drink more than anything else that morning. And I went over to Class 6 Sales on the base and bought a bottle of vodka and drove out into the orange groves north of the base there at El Toro and drank hot vodka in my car that day, afraid I'd wake up and I'd be so terrified that the next thing I'd see would be a military police jeep coming after me. And that was repeated many times, and it was insane, absolutely crazy. And I put that on my list. I put a lot of things on my list. I put about, after I got out of the Marine Corps, about a step ahead of a bad conduct discharge, I moved to Glendale, California. I lived in an apartment for a while and then in a car and then in what I called a garage. My wife Linda and I were over in that area not long, a couple of years ago, and she said, "I want to see that garage." And we drove down in that area, and they'd taken the building down behind it, and so we could see it clearly from a street behind it. And she said, "Is that it?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "That's not a garage. That's a shed, is what that is." And I had lived there with three guys, dying there. While I still had a car, I was arrested one morning for drunk driving. I was just trying to get well. And I was headed down to get a real drink because the beer that they were feeding me at one tavern was not getting the job done. And I stopped for a red light, and the light turned green and amber and red and green, amber, red. I was resting, kind of gathering myself for the... And there was a cop right behind me. And so he's up rapping at the window. I don't know why when he got my attention, I noticed he wasn't even wearing his hat. And he did what they do. Get out of the car. But touch your nose. Not a very elaborate series of commands. On the police report after he arrested me, he wrote, "I discontinued the field sobriety test because the suspect was injuring himself." And that goes on my list. And of course, I want a jury trial. I want justice. I was to go into that Glendale jail many times. And I lost that car. I don't know what happens. The cars seize up somehow. I was saving for an oil change, but I don't have any idea what goes... I used to think those hoods were factory sealed, I guess. I never... And that went on my list, and there were a lot of things. And I took my list back to this guy. He said, "That's an interesting list, colorful list." I smiled shyly and said, "Yes." He said, "But it does not include the craziest thing you ever did." I said, "What is that?" He said, "Well, there's a lot of alcohol on this list. Not all of it, but there's a lot of alcohol. And you drank. And you did all these crazy things. But the craziest thing you ever did, and you did it repeatedly, you did before you started to drink." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "With all of this evidence in your life that you should never drink again, you repeatedly went insane enough before you started to drink to decide to have a drink. That's insane. That's insane." And it touched me to see that, to know that there's an obsession going on with me, and I don't have any choice. I don't have any power. I don't have any strength or control. It occurs to me to drink, I drink. I drink when it doesn't occur to me to drink. I drink when that glass is right here. and you might as well. There is my mind goes someplace, and I don't have any power, and I want power. Bob and I were talking. We're power seekers. We like power. We really want power. There's people here in Huntsville that don't care anything about power. None of them here today. But there are those folks. Can you imagine? And we want it so much, and it's so basic to us that we don't even know how much we want power. I was, when I was a little kid, I knew that I should have power. My mom, you're a big boy now. Do this, do that, you should do this, you should do... And I didn't seem to have any power. And I knew that I didn't have any power, but I learned that I, number one, should have it if I were a good person. And number two, the task came to be to keep you from finding out I didn't have any power. But lack of power is a dilemma for us. If we weren't power seekers, if we didn't care about power, lack of power would not be a dilemma, would it? It would be, hey, okay, but I don't have any power. And the day came when somehow I got that. I was on the street, living out of that shed, warrants out for my arrest. I have three sons. I hadn't seen them in some years. I hadn't talked to their... There were two wives. I hadn't talked to them. My mailing address was General Delivery, Glendale. There were bad checks all over town. I'm shuffling along the street one day. And I don't know what I looked like. I got a very interesting glimpse of Earl, who I've known a few years, last night. Can you, this guy that was up here vital and laughing and carrying on and touching us, he's gone now. I guess he heard what he came to hear. I thoroughly enjoyed his talk, and I was very touched by one part of it, especially when he's like, he's got this hair and this beard, and he's in AA for a little bit, and he's in the back of a meeting, and I know the meeting. I wasn't there, but I know that meeting, and I know that when his sponsor grabbed the mic and said, "Earl, we're having a meeting here," I know that Earl was in the back of the room disrupting. Why else would he do that? I know that Earl was in the back of the room mumbling to himself and talking, and we see people like that, and they come into AA, and we're immediately kind of disdainful of them. Can you imagine somebody with a drinking problem coming into a meeting like that? It's just... And of course, Earl was sober by that time, but he was... And when you compare that vision to what we saw last night, you know that none of us see ourselves. I did not know as I shuffled along the street of Glendale what I looked like, what kind of an... But a car slowed and stopped, and a guy said, "Where are you going?" And I don't know what I said. He said, he was a bail bondsman with whom I had done some business. And he said, "I'm going to take you someplace today." Don Armstrong. Armstrong Bail Bonds. Glendale, California, and he's going to take me someplace today, and one of the, you know what, I didn't ask. I said, okay. I didn't know if we were going back to jail. I didn't know if we were going to one of the local laughing academies there. They have fidget farms. They didn't have any charm schools in that case. They had one place out in the valley run by a guy named Ron Shire. He called it Shire's Dryer. And it's gone now, but it was kind of a spin-dry operation. In and out, in and out. I'm going to take you someplace today. And he brought me to you. He brought me to you. And he had never brought anybody before or since, and he brought me to you. I have, it's interesting. I grew up in a very religious home and I rejected it early. I knew and was told and never believed that God is love and that God works through people. And I look back on that day and know that God was loving me through that guy. And he didn't even know it. He didn't know what he did for me, because I call him every year on my birthday and thank him for that. First couple of years I called him, he'd say, Clint, who are you? And you know what I like about AA is that when he would ask that question, I knew the answer. And I could say it. It's just a little thing, but if you're new here, you know what I mean. You know you have to hang up that payphone fast, because they'll trace the call. And pretty soon they'll come and get you. He brought me to you. And I was around here for 3 weeks in meetings and drunk for two, bad drunk for two. And came back that morning, the 14th of August, 1966. Whipped. No intention of signing on for anything like 32 years. No intention of doing anything but trying to make it through that day. And drinking is great training for what we do here, because drinking is a day at a time. Drinking is doing everything you can to get the job done today. And I wanted to get through that day, and I didn't know anything about anything. I just knew I was lost. And I had walked from the little shed over to the club in Glendale that morning, and I got there mid-morning, and there was a guy in that club that morning doing his job in AA, because he had the door open and the coffee on. And he asked me how I was doing. The way they do, I said, I'm not doing so good. He said, what happened? I said, well, I got drunk and let everybody down. He asked me a great question. He said, oh, are you alcoholic? Not a bad question. I said, yeah, I've been an alcoholic about a month now. Something like that. And he let that go. He didn't go after me. He just said, well, if you're alcoholic, you say you're alcoholic and you drank? Yeah. That's what we do. That's what we do. Earl said it last night. We're going to drink no matter what. We do that. Look them right in the eye. And we drink. He said, that's going to be you. That is you. And so you didn't let us down when you drank. I wouldn't want you to think you let us down. You didn't surprise us either. He said, in fact, if you want to surprise us, get a job. That is surprising. Drinking? No, hell no, you're going to drink. He gave me the simple dignity of the fact of the matter, and there was a kindness to it. And he just kind of let me see it. He let me see it, and the 2 weeks preceding had, and I asked him, what am I going to do? He wouldn't talk about tomorrow. He would not. He wouldn't talk about the warrants. He wouldn't talk about the kids. He just said, stay here today. There's a meeting at noon and a meeting tonight. Stay here. Don't go out there. And I knew that day that I would always drink. I knew there was no more quitting for me. I had tried to quit. If you knew, I heard Bob say this a couple of years ago. If you look at us and think we've quit and that you don't have what it takes, Neither do we. Neither do we. We're not drinking anymore, but quitting is not part of it. And I knew that day I would never quit, and nobody had to tell me that. I know it's impossible for me to quit, because I had tried to quit. I quit a couple times a day. This is the last pint I'm going to need. And I go down there again. And if you're new and you know you can't quit, you must also know this. It's not required. What's required is that you make a simple request of a God that you cannot believe in, that he remove that obsession. Herb said he's either removed it or he hasn't. And I think it turns on whether we can ask. And I don't think we know how we've asked. I had asked, apparently, that long, hideous night of the 14th of October, 1966, because I didn't drink again. And I knew I would always drink. And I find that something, because I can't quit. You'd think if it was about quitting here and there, Mike read the steps up here today, wouldn't it go like this? Step one, quit. Knock it off. Be a man. Step one says basically you got to get that you are toast. And that is very basic, incidentally. You want to go back to basics? That's basic for me. I'm toast. In and of myself, I'm not going to be able to be free of it. I can't do that. If I could have done it, I would have done it. People that can quit aren't here today. They're in church, or they're having breakfast, or whatever they're doing, they're not here. You know why? Because they quit. They quit. And so if you're new, you're in a room full of people that cannot quit. And if you cannot quit, and you've come to that conclusion, welcome. Welcome. If you don't have any power over this stuff, welcome. I think the fact that I had begged was lost on me because I couldn't remember it. And because my prayers were so profane and angry that they did not seem like prayers. Weird prayers. I heard a gal in a meeting a couple of years later, Gail Wilson died sober, about my age, attractive woman at the podium, had integrity. And she's talking about the alcoholic's prayer. And I was attracted to her. And I'm new and I'm in the audience and I'm liking her. She seemed a little skeptical about AA. She wasn't, and I don't think she was, but it was kind of her presentation. And she was talking about coming, she got me in the room because she talked about coming out of a blackout in her apartment in Hollywood, sitting on the mantel over the fireplace. And you gotta like a girl like that. And she was up there with her cat. And there was a little vodka and cat food there, something for everybody. And as this story unfolded, it turned out that there was, the reason they were up there, she and the cat, was because there was about 4 inches of water on the floor in her apartment. And that was because she had started to take a bath last Thursday and the whole deal got away from her. Gail, let's have dinner. Oh my God, I'd like to get to know you better. You won't criticize me, Gail. You're a pig and I love that about you. And then she told us what the alcoholic's prayer is for her. Jesus, God, what's wrong with me? That prayer. Somebody told me about the guys that were part of an amphibious landing in Italy during the Second World War, how they had been dumped off that on that beach, and the Germans had defended it. Bitter fighting. And guys were stuck at the edge of the water and couldn't move inland. The intelligence was wrong, and the weather was bad, and there was just wave after wave of people coming in, and no place to go because they were held down by machine gun fire and small arms fire, and the reconnaissance wasn't very good, and the intelligence was bad. And these guys stacked up, and they knew they were going. One, and the grave registration detail came through after the beach had been secured, and they took pieces of paper out of dead hands. Guys knew, and they would write a letter home or a poem. A prayer. One guy's prayer touched me. I didn't feel it was blasphemous, but he said, and I knew how you get there. He said, God, come. Come now. Come yourself. Do not send your son. This is no place for children. And I went, oh my God. We long for that. We long to go. And I was growing up, I grew up in a home where religion was the deal. Angry. Oh, they were angry. My dad was drunk and angry. And when he left, and he was gone for about 4 years, my mom allowed her anger to surface in it. Got very colorful around there, and I turned away from all of that religion. I didn't like it. I didn't like the people that were delivering the message. And I didn't like the message. And I knew that I really... It's interesting, isn't it? All of the ideas of God that I could have selected, I chose one I didn't like. I chose one I was afraid of. I had this crazy idea that it was up to me to demonstrate to God what I could do for Him. That if I really lived an exemplary life, He would notice and help me out. But I can't do that long enough to get His attention. About 3 days into it, I'm having dirty thoughts again. Not realistic, but they were certainly dirty. And I knew it. It turns out that's not true. I don't want to leave it there. It isn't up to me to demonstrate what I can do for God. God will demonstrate through me what He can do. My job is to live my life in such a way that God can love other people through me. It's like this remarkable woman that I am married to. My love for her is going to be conditional. I can guarantee you that. It's like, what dress does she have to wear tonight for my ego to calm down? And that's just the tip of that iceberg. And so, my attempts to give unconditional love are bound to fail. But I know that God loves me through her. And I live my life, I make a daily effort to live my life in such a way that God can love her through me. I was, she's a remarkable human being. And we woke up one morning and I said, Saturday morning, I said, what do you want to do today? She said, let's give up an old idea. I said, what? What? I said, oh, okay. She said, good, you go first. I don't even know what the hell that means, but I had been thinking about something interesting. It's like in the book it says, God will constantly disclose more to you and to others. I don't have a sense of constant disclosure, do you? And I had been chewing on the notion that I have little rules about how that disclosure ought to go. I don't want to get a message from the guy in the next lane on the freeway. So there's no disclosure there because I don't get it. I don't want to get a message from a guy I sponsor. It's all right if my sponsor gives me a little disclosure. It's all right if, you know. And I don't want to get one from my wife. And yet, he will constantly disclose. And he does it through people. How else would he do that? Sometimes intuitive thought, but through people. And I gave up that day the idea that I can impose restrictions and rules on who the messenger is. And it's, I was so touched when Marcia was talking about her father. We have these old ideas and we give them up. We allow them to die. She devoted her life to living it in such a way that God could love her father through her. And I think, and I haven't talked to Marcia about this, but I think it's why she had extraordinary capacity and energy and compassion. And you have to give up an old idea. What is that? Maybe that she can't have a father. Maybe that there will never be any healing. That idea has to go. And so there has been, in an odd way, this weekend, talk about death. The death of old ideas. Old ideas are fascinating to me. Old ideas are like this. There was a guy that I knew in L.A., and then he moved up to the Silicon Valley. His name is Billy. Billy came back through L.A. after a few years up there, and he's a nice guy and a wonderful guy, and I love him, and he loves me, and we talk. We kind of connect. Billy hears me, and I hear Billy. And he was excited because they had offered him a different job, a job where he was going to go out into the field and solve the computer programming problems of customers there. And it involved a car, and it involved a little staff, and it involved more responsibility, and it involved a raise. And he was thrilled that they'd offered him this. I said, "When do you start?" He said, "Oh, I can't take it." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, I can't take it. And I said, "Why not?" And he told me that he couldn't take it because they wanted him to cut his hair. He had long hair. I said, "Well, they have a right to ask you to cut your hair and be presentable. What is that?" He said, "No, they don't have that right." I said, "Billy, I used to think that kind of talk meant a guy was hard of hearing and I would raise the volume a little bit. But I've grown so mellow in my..." I let it go. We came back to it a little later. I said, "What's with the hair?" And I said, "Don't. Don't even go there. Don't even go there." And he told me something eventually that afternoon that he had never told anybody. He said, "You know why I can't cut my hair? My ears are badly deformed." And I had never heard that about him, and it didn't quite land. And so we get going on something else, and I come out. I said, "Let me see your ears." And he trusts me, and so he brought his hair back. And I saw a shocking sight. His ears looked like my ears. And I went, "Billy, I got a newsflash for you, pal." "Those ears aren't beauties, but they're not deformed." I had a mirror in the den. After a while, he couldn't believe that. We're up looking in the mirror. looking at our ears. If you're new and you want what we have, he finally said, God, they're so big. So I get a little ruler out of my desk and we're up here. Right. And he finally began to kind of get a glimpse of it. And I said, that's an old idea. Where'd you get that old idea? And he said, like a true alcoholic, he said, I don't know. And we don't know. We don't know. And I said, well, how does it make you feel? And we know that. And if we look, we know when that started, that feeling. He said, it makes me feel like a clown. I mean, we're down there to the bottom of it now. And I said, I can see why you wouldn't want to cut your hair and go out in the field. People will laugh at you. He said, yeah, that's the problem. I said, when did you feel that way first? And he told me a story about coming home from school in the third grade, and everything was just great. He's coming in. He's going to run in the house. His mom is going to give him a cookie. She's going to send him out to play and call him for supper, and he'll come back in. I said, it sounded like a good day, and he said it was. I said, something jarred you pretty good. He said, yeah. I said, what happened? Because he's open and vulnerable and loving, and he runs in the house, and his mother's on the phone. And she's on the phone with her sister, and he knew that because he heard his mother call her by name, his Aunt Betty. She said, oh, my God, Betty, I got to hang up now. Billy just came running in, and little pictures have big ears. And it just goes into your midbrain. And he's, as soon as he could grow his hair, he did. Covered him up. He saw that look on his mother's face. He heard about the ears. And he didn't need any more information, and he didn't ask any questions. We don't ask questions. We're not good at that. We don't want the answer. We're going to get whatever it is. It's usually, how many questions am I going to ask after I've heard about 100 times? Because whatever the question is, the answer is, because I said so. The answer is, because the Bible says it. Okay. Whatever. But I don't ask anymore. He didn't ask. And an old idea was born. It says in the 12 and 12, about step 8, it's talking about our list, our amends list. And at one part of it, it says that even though there may not be an amends owing to a resentment, we nevertheless ought to make an exhaustive survey of our past life, because hidden, sometimes long forgotten events have created and twisted our emotions and altered our personalities for the worse. And I think step 4 is a great place to do that, to take a look at those old ideas. They come floating up. When Billy saw that his ears were okay and understood why he thought they were not, that old idea was on its way out the door. Because, see, it had no power over it. It had no more power over it. And we started laughing and we started crying. And we were whooping and hollering around there and... He called me about a week later from up north where he had returned, and he'd gotten a haircut and took that job, and he is kicking butt in the Silicon Valley today. And I was intrigued. This has been a few years. I was intrigued by this. I was intrigued by the fact that in the book Wilson says we have to give up our old ideas. We try to hang on to them, and the result is nil. Because I've got it wired up in a very weird way. I know you can't trust God. I know that. I know that, and it's funny, you know, talk about, I was talking to Father Terry Steve knows him from Southern California. Wonderful guy. And he and I are talking. We're at a conference someplace, and I'd gone up to thank him, and a cowboy came up, and he, from Reno, I guess. And this cowboy was so glad to be there. And he had come, he said, "Terry, I've driven clear across the state of Nevada to hear you, and I'm glad I did." Terry said, "You have a good trip?" He said, "It was an amazing trip." He said, "What made it amazing?" He said, "God came with me." He said, "Well, that's good." He said, "No, he got into the pickup right around Elko and came on in with me." And I thought, that's so. And Terry said, "What did you find out about God?" And this guy said, "Well, he's real smart." Terry said, "Well, that's good." He said, "There's something else I found out about God." He said, "What?" He said, "As he was there in that truck with me, I found out he's not pissed off. He's not mad. And I always thought he was. He's not mad." And so if you're new here, and you cannot quit, and you're an alcoholic of my type, you can get freedom if you can ask. Because he's not mad. You may have made some people mad along the way. He's not mad. And you can tap into that power and join us here. He's not mad. We think our prayers won't get there because they're angry and profane. I don't think he cares. He honors the slightest turn in his direction. Come on home. Come on home. It's really quite amazing. A guy gave me a reproduction of that painting, The Return of the Prodigal Son. A wonderful painting. And the old man has his hands on the son's shoulders, and there's so much love and compassion, and the son is kneeling in front of his father, and he, man, has been through the mill. You can tell his bones are showing through the clothes he was wearing. And his brother was there. He isn't going for it. But he'd come home. And his father had welcomed him. And his brother is saying, "He's been out running around with those. He's been in the far country, man, and you're welcoming him." And sometimes we do that. We're the son or the daughter. And after a while, we become the brother. You know, somebody comes through the doors of AA, and we go, "I don't know. How come he gets to come here? Hitting on all the women like that, the way I want to do." It's a fascinating trip. There is a notion, then, that we can live some life apart from God and apart from each other. And then we see in this remarkable book, in that chapter called We Agnostics, it doesn't apply to us. Some amazing stuff. Do you know that the step two, chapter four is about step two. Came to believe that we could, a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And when I was taken through that a few years ago, by guys that knew that book, changed my life. After many years of sobriety, it changed my life. Because they said, you can pick a vision of sanity. You can pick your own idea. Right now, it's like you're in a raft in the middle of the Pacific, and you've got one oar, and the best you can do is drive yourself around in little circles. You ain't going anywhere. You sure aren't going where you want to go, and you haven't even thought about what sanity would look like. But you can choose. You can choose. You can either circle the drain, or put that oar up in the air, put your shirt there, and catch that power greater than you are. And it'll move you. See, the thing that we know is that if I can come to believe in a God that will move me beyond this point, wherever I happen to be, I'm in good shape. And if, but it takes, you know what has to happen? I have to, an old idea has to die. And the old idea is that it's up to me to demonstrate to God what I can do. And it never was. Never was. We talk about selfishness and self-centeredness in the program, and it didn't resonate much for me until somebody said, you know, I don't think you want anything out of my pile, and I don't want anything out of yours. You're not acquisitive and selfish in that way. But the selfishness that's killing you is the idea that you have to do it all yourself. And they took me over to where Wilson in his story says, that had to die. That self-centeredness and that selfishness had to die. And you can tell what he meant because in the very next sentence he says, I must turn in all things to the Father of light that presides over us all. Self-sufficiency will fail and it always causes fear. And so, in that We Agnostics chapter, coming just out of the bedevilments, out of those nine, I couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. I was having trouble with personal relationships. What would that look like if God removed the insanity of it? Just that part about trouble with personal relationships, I guess I'd be safe to be around. Couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. I guess I would notice and be respectful of the fact that I can be useful. This is not brain surgery. Well, in a way it is. This is the beginning of an entire psychic change that Silkworth talks about. Because my mind has gotten in the way, it's like a prison. Good is coming all the time. Disclosure is coming all the time. And my mind, with my old ideas and the funny way I've got it wired up, will turn it into something else. I knew when I was 5 years old I couldn't trust my mother. It never was true, and I knew it was true. She brought my little sister home from the hospital, and it was all right for a while, but up until then I had adored my mother, and she had adored me. And we would whisper our secrets, and we would laugh and pray, and she'd tuck me in. And now it's all gone, and she's spending all that time with my sister, and she doesn't have any time for me, and they even have set up a little room for her. It's just, I never really... She said, well, I'm going to bring a baby home from the hospital. I'm great. Knock yourself out. I had no idea they intended to keep that kid. And so I would go in that little room where they kept her and encourage her to move out. And my mom caught me one day thumping her on the head or whatever. I want things to go back to where they are, and I'm going to make a change. And she picked me up, scared her. And she was angry anyway. And before I landed in the hall, I knew she didn't love me. And I knew something else I knew she never had. I knew it had all been a hideous betrayal. And after that, she and I went to war. I was 8 years old, and she would have to beat me with an ironing cord to get me to mow the lawn. And she could get me to mow the lawn, but she couldn't get me to clip around the sidewalk. I drew the line, by God. And I did something else. I said, at one level or another, I said, you don't love me, I don't love you. I don't love you. And I was 13 when she found that lump, and we moved back to Billings and lived in the basement of my grandma's house. And my grandma took her upstairs, had her daughter back, nursed her. And she'd go in the hospital and come back. And the treatment in those days was savage. And it took her about a year to die. One morning in the spring, my grandma opened the door to the cellar where the four kids were, four of us now. And she yelled out, she said, your mother died last night, are you going to go to school or not? And I thought, I'll go to school. And I stood at my mother's grave in the lower end part of the cemetery at Billings a couple of days later, and they buried her. And I'm at, you don't love me. I don't love you either. I don't love you. And you try to make that true because it hurts too much. And those old ideas are snapping in there, boy. Don't trust them. Don't love them. It ends, and it ends badly. I stopped breathing deeply that day. Just breathing up on the surface. That's all that happened. I didn't cry. I just stopped breathing deeply. 2 years went by, and a guy handed me vodka at a party after a football game. I'm 16. And I started breathing deeply again. Yeah. It started for me when I was 16 at a party, and when the party was over, I was 29 and living in the shed in Glendale, California. And the party had been over for a while. And I was lost. I heard somebody say one night, when you've been lost, really lost, you never get over the wonder of being found again. And I never have. I never have. I didn't sign on for 32 years. I did not. I've lived half my life, more than half my life, I'm 62, with you. I didn't sign on for that. Nor should you, if you're new. No. Just be here with us today. And so I had a lot of old ideas, and I had them wired up. And you know, once you decide that your mother, you know, another old idea, you have to work up another old idea. If she doesn't love me, how come she's still here? Well, I figured it out. She can't leave. She has to stay. It's the only reason she would stay. Which became an interesting part of my life later on in selecting mates. If I wanted to bring somebody into my life, I would bring somebody in that was unable to leave. Economically or whatever. Because if they can leave, they will leave. And of course, it never worked out. But you have these old ideas, and when you can let them go, you're freeing up. You're freeing up. I love Steve's story. When he allowed to die, the idea that his happiness depended on the fidelity of his ex-wife, he was free. He was free. It's a sweet and harsh and bitter and funny and amazing story that he told. I was glad to hear it. Well, Bob spoke about his wife and finally saw why she might have left. He allowed to die an old idea that said, they can't leave me. I'll tell them when they can go. And I had that old idea. And it makes for a time. We're addicted to a drug called approval, and we marry our dealer and wonder why we're having trouble with it. Does cause a little tension. And in that chapter 4, in that there is a place where it says, don't let any antagonism, prejudice you have against spiritual terms, deter you from asking yourself what they honestly mean to you. And they made me go through that book, that chapter, the capitalized terms they said, assume they're spiritual terms. Set aside your prejudice. Define really what they mean to you. And I did that, and I discovered that's a wonderful exercise, because I discovered that those terms meant something to me. Outside of what I had rejected as a kid, deep in me, there's a place that belongs only to God. And there's another place that's so interesting. Somebody told me one day, said, you've got to have some compassion for that little piece in you that's never going to get it. Oh, God. And that piece is there, man. And I can fight it or I can love it. It's the piece that needs loving the most. And so I like to see a rogue in an AA meeting because I instinctively don't like him. And I instinctively think he's never going to get it. And when I develop compassion for him, I can develop some for me. And so I like those rogues. I find out about them. I let them know I'm glad they're there. They don't believe it, but I let them know anyway. There's another interesting thing in that fourth. It says, is God everything or nothing? I said, I don't know. I don't know. He's not nothing. But I said, well, there's a great way to find out how all that works for you. I said, well, I said, make a list of everything that's more important to you than a better relationship with God. Well, that's an interesting list. I mean, these guys are like, they're going at it. And I'm hanging in there because my life in sobriety wasn't going so good. I'd been sober too long to admit it, but it was not going good. I lost what I had brought into my life to try to get power. I had an income stream and a house and a relationship and a law practice by this time, and I'm trying lawsuits downtown, naming the paper stuff and making money. And one day my partner came to me and said, I don't want to do this with you anymore. One day the relationship came, I don't want to be here anymore. And the house went on the market and the address changed and my income stream dropped and the burn rate was as high as it had ever been. That was always interesting. Still owed a lot of money. None coming in. I lost my identity because it's all around an image. And that's what took me to these steps again. That failure, that deep sense of fear that I'm too old. I was 53. I was 23 years sober. And I lost it all. I thought I did. There's a guy in San Diego who says, we don't know the difference between everything and nothing. We think we've lost everything and are left with nothing, but the everything we lost turned out to be nothing, and the nothing we're left with turns out to be the whole damn thing. But I was a little annoyed. And it's funny, it has all come back in ways that I can enjoy it, hold it with an open hand. And so, is God everything or nothing? List the five things you won't give up in favor of a better relationship with God. Oh, I got five things. Sex, control, anger, money, my career, running the show. Hey, great, good. I think I had seven things on my list. And they said, great. So now we know. I said, what do we know? He said, well, a better relationship with God is number eight. At least we know what everything is. It's those eight things. With God at the bottom. And you go into those first seven things for your power. All I want to do is make enough money so I don't have to trust God. That's not too much to ask, is it? What am I going to do with my list? They said, ask that it be. You want to become willing to have that reprioritized for you. And willing means gladly ready. I thought it meant gun to the head time. No. Gladly ready. Take me to a place where I'm gladly ready to have all these things not taken out of my life, but reprioritized. They'll be taken out if they're no good at a later step. It's ancient. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Honor thy parents. Doesn't say honor them if they're doing it your way. Just honor them. Those tablets. I like that story. Moses came down with the tablets and he gathered the guys around him and said, I got good news and bad. They said, give us the good news. He said, well, I got him down to 10. He said, what's the bad news? And Moses said, adultery's still on the list. That's a remarkable chapter, chapter 4. Remarkable. Remarkable. And it, and then the question, where is he? Where is he? Where is this power? Deep down within? Is there, and here's the real question. Is there a place inside me where I can go where God is? Because I had, when I prayed, I was praying up and out. Up there, up there. Practicing the absence of God. Instead of the presence of God. He's in me. He's in me. It's, I can find a place. And I did in a hotel room in San Diego. One morning. Because I'm wanting that contact. I need it so bad. And I'm down there trying a lawsuit. And I'm in the hotel room before I go across the street. And the other guy's got his case over with. And it's my turn to put on my part of the deal. That's the easy part when you can put on yours. You know what's going to happen. And I'm there and I'm going inside. Because the promise is when we draw near to Him, He will disclose Himself to us. Well, if He's inside, then I gotta go inside. I gotta find a safe place in there. They call that some kind of meditation or rudimentary looking around. And I got to where I was saying, you promised if I drew near to you, you would disclose yourself. Give me a disclosure. And that morning in that hotel in San Diego, I found a place. And when you found it, you know it. And my life has never been the same. And I went across the street and finished that deal up over there. It took me a couple of days. But I did it from a different place. It worked out fine. I called the deputy mayor of the city I was representing down there. And he said, how did you do that? And I didn't want to tell him that I didn't do it. So I just said, that's what you hired me for. Just to love those people. Funny place to love them, isn't it? And so the inventory got to be an interesting thing. It's all about power. I mean, why would Wilson have me start with the people I resent? Because I see those people as more powerful than I am. That's even a guy on the street in Los Angeles that comes up and asks me for a buck at that moment has enough power to make me feel weird. Why would he have a fear inventory in there? Because what am I afraid of? Institutions and principles and people that seem more powerful than me. What about that sex inventory? It's a list, really, of all the ways in which I have tried to extract power from a situation that's not a legitimate source of power. My pathetic little attempt to get power. And I mistreated people badly, badly. I heard a gal, I read that to another guy and God was there. I looked at those old ideas and thought of them as character defects and had character defects and anger and lust and all of that stuff. And it's easy to figure out what it is. And the ideas that aren't working come floating up to the surface. Because we think, well, hell, anybody be mad at that. No. It's idiosyncratic. This is, my anger is because this person has broken one of my rules. It's just my rule based on an old idea. Like, who's supposed to give me disclosure? I get mad if I get it from the wrong person. Really, do you? How interesting. We care. Doesn't matter. Just open to it. Seven is wonderful. To have all that stuff, and by that time you're tapping in a little bit to power. And you're saying, I'm ready to have these things removed. All of it. And you say that prayer. See, what's happened is, at step three, that prayer is just an offer. I offer myself to thee. And at step seven is, take whatever you want to take. I'll let it all go. I was up in, it's funny how I had these hits along the way, because I'm up in Northern California, and a lady from Reno named Judy was talking about how when she was 10 years sober, she wanted to get over her fear of heights. And she started to take skydiving lessons. That would not have been my deal, but she's... And the day came, she's supposed to solo out of a plane, and it's coming, and her in the drop zone is her husband and her ex-husband and the woman she sponsored and her kids. And she came over and came out of that airplane, and she had packed the parachute, and it was off. And she landed going a lot faster than she intended to. And as she said it, I spent the next 18 months in a hospital learning how to urinate again. And you kind of got, man, that is a rather sudden stop. But she's up there telling the story, and she tells this story. She said about 8 months into it, I'm in a rehab place, an extended care facility. And my husband has left me, but my ex-husband comes back into my life. He's a member of AA, and he and I become friends. And he's sitting in the hospital room talking to me one day, and he said, what was that about? And she said, I just wanted to get over my fear of height. And he started to laugh. And she said, what are you laughing at? And he said, all you had to do was humbly ask. Oh, God. Oh, my God. Oh, God. I jumped out of airplanes all my sobriety. I didn't know. And I asked. Well, amends are a big thing. I've got to sit down. But I want you to know that direct amends. We are in an era, an age where we have a database manager in my home group. I think that's... I don't know if I could get sober with a database manager. I'm not ready for all of that. I heard a gal talk the other day. She came out of a blackout in a chat room. What is that? People are making amends by email. I'm way behind because I don't type real well. Direct amends. God, what a gift that is. To go back to those women. I took their dignity. And I had to give it back. They said, go to them. Make them the appointment. Direct amends. Sit with them. Not at a meal. Not in their place or yours. Neutral place. Coffee. Tell them what you're there for. Thank him for being with you. Tell him exactly the harm you've caused. Ask him if they need to tell you how any of that made him feel. And listen. And then ask him, what can I do to set that right? And listen. Because you're going to get some marching orders. And I went to my brother in Portland, and I went to my sister in Denver, and I went to my kids and their mothers, and the women along the way. I wasn't going to go to that graveyard in Billings. I had several opportunities to do that, and I hadn't taken them. Now I'm under new management, and the chance came again, and I went to Billings. And I found that grave in the low-rent part of the cemetery. And I knelt there, and Al-Anon had given me a bag that day of things I could. She said, take this with you. There was a liter of water in it and some clippers, and there were some flower seeds, and there were some Kleenex, and there were some paper towels. She said, you'll need these things out there. And I went out there. A guy drove me. I didn't intend to spend 5 hours out there. I kneeled down at that grave and planted those seeds. Clancy, my sponsor, told me to take a letter out there. I buried that letter. And I went down the row and found my grandma's grave. And I knelt there for a little bit. I came back up to my mom's grave and I noticed that that place needed sprucing up a little bit, and she had given me these clippers, and I found myself clipping around the edge. The thing I would never do.
No, no.
You don't love me?
I don't love you either.
And the tears came, and I thought they would never stop. I'd get up, I'd think I was done, I'd walk over to that car, and the guy would turn the engine on, and then I'd turn around and go back. But there was a lot of freedom in there. She loved me. And every day it came, she didn't love me. And I miss her. I would like to be with her now. But I am. I talk to her a little bit sometimes. I went to a grave in Roanoke where my dad is. This is amazing stuff. It's so easy to, I'll make a living amends. I don't know. I know that my job in AA has become the job of taking guys, they 15, 18 years sober, and they come to me and they say, take me through the steps. And I sit with them. Saturday morning, one-on-one. At its heart, this program is simple and personal. One alcoholic talking to another, sharing experience, strength, and hope. And these guys, because I did it thoroughly, I can ask them to do that. And they get out there on the road. I have a guy that's a general contractor. And he had left some messes out there. And he had to go contact these people and say, I walked away from this job not having done it. And I came back to clean that up. What can I do? And he was told things like, you can fix the leaks in the roof is what you can do. And for a year and a half, he spent about half his time cleaning it up. And his income went up. I have another guy that shouldn't be on the streets. And he had to go to a guy that runs a bicycle shop in Santa Monica and say, a few years ago, you had a situation where somebody backed a pickup truck in here about midnight and loaded a bunch of bikes in it and drove out through that plate glass window. He said, yeah. He said, that was me, and I came back to clean it up. The guy said, what can I do to make that? He said, don't do that anymore. And I got a call not long ago from a guy. I knew he was on his last amends. And there, you can finish him. He had been in South Pasadena burglarizing homes. And he was down to the last home, knocking on doors, saying, were you here 4 years ago when your house was burglarized? I did that. And I came to clean it up. And he called me one day and he said, I knew that morning he called me. He said, I'm going to go do the last one today if they're home. I said, well, sit out in front a little bit and make sure that you have the power. Because the prayer changes. Take me to my next amends and give me the power to make it. And this guy called me about noon that day. He said, I finished it. I said, where are you? He said, I'm still on the street. Nobody locked me up. I said, how'd it go? He said, they invited me in. Older man and woman. And they talked to me a while. And I told them what I needed to tell them, and I asked them what I could do to make it right. And they said, you've done it. You've done it, because up until right now, we've always thought our son did that. A lot of freedom in this deal, you know? And healing. And a family was changed forever because that guy was willing to make amends. And you can't do that without power. You've got to tap into power. But the power is here. The power is here. Page 28 is, if what we've seen and heard and felt means anything at all, it means that each of us, no matter our creed, color, education, can form a personally satisfying living relationship with God as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try. And it took me a few years to be willing and honest enough to try, but I'll tell you something, it's doable, and it's easily doable. And I welcome you if you're new. I hope you're just willing to notice that you can't quit and you really need power in your life and you can't put it there. It's available. Tap into it. Thanks.